Welcome to this episode of My Journey as a Physicist. Each episode features an interview with a physicist to learn about their work, their interest outside of physics, and their professional journey of how they ended up where they are today. Season 3 features physicists involved in the long-range plan for nuclear science. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Welcome, Romana Vogt. It's great to have you here. To get started, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I got my PhD in 1989. I have been doing physics ever since. I started out as a postdoc in Livermore and then in Germany. And I've been I was a staff scientist at LBL in Berkeley. And then I moved to Livermore. I've also been an adjunct professor in UC Davis since 1995. I've been back in Livermore as a regular staff member since 2007. I also like to read history, big fan of MCU, and I like listening to music, various kinds, and I run.
Nice. Yeah, it's always good to stay healthy. Yeah, just to follow up on those, you gave two acronyms. I guess they're not acronyms. That one of them I didn't recognize. I think I recognized the other one. You said GSI and LBL.
Yeah. That's the Gesellschaft für Schwerionen und Forschung, or Institute for Heavy Ion Research in Germany. It's in, near the Frankfurt Airport, out in the forest. Nice place to run.
yeah, I bet. And then LBL, that is Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, right?
Yes, it is.
Beyond that, can you give us some ideas of what your research is about?
So I did my thesis research on GSI suppression and heavy ion collisions way back when, and I'm still involved in that area, at least part of the time. I'm going to be doing work on that as part of a nuclear theory topical collaboration that was just approved in December, or at least was publicized as, you know, as one of the new topical collaborations. So that's a five-year collaboration. Once I started at Livermore, I started doing a phenomenology of nuclear fission, and I work on a code called Freya for the Nordic goddess. It actually stands for Fission Reaction Event Yield Algorithm. And I work on that with Niren Randrup from LBL. And we like to put this little picture of Freya because she's a Nordic goddess who's known for riding in a chariot pulled by cats. Mm-hmm. And I also like to say that, you know, getting theorists to collaborate sometimes is like herding cats.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. So overall, you'd say you're a nuclear theorist or a high energy theorist?
Nuclear theorist, but certainly close relations to high energy in the sense that the heavy flavor particles that I like to study are produced in collisions from fixed target all the way up to the LHC.
Yeah, that's sometimes there's just a blurred, a gray area between nuclear and
nuclear structure and on high energy collisions in the sense that if you have two lead nuclei that are pretty much spherical hitting each other, you could maybe get a different density profile than if you're colliding uranium on uranium. Yeah, they're fairly deformed and they're more like cigar shape in some sense. Mm-hmm. So people did studies of, you know, if you have like side on side or tip on tip or tip on side, you can get different particle densities depending on the on which configuration.
Yeah, I think I recall something about heavy ion collisions and both of the atoms look like pancakes or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's a Lorentz contraction. And you get an enormous boost in the Z direction. So the transverse direction isn't changed, but it's limited by the uncertainty principle. So there's still, you know, instead of being like a radius of like seven Fermis, or more like a single Fermi.
All right. And then, so what does a typical day for you look like? If there is such a thing.
There is no such thing. Right now I telecommute 80% of the time since the pandemic. And it's been really nice right now because it's been raining so much that, you know, it's nice to not have to worry about flooding, you know, getting into flooded roads or something. And right now I'm a lot involved in a lot of stuff that isn't exactly like normal physics because I'm involved with the APS, the American Physical Society, and the Nuclear Science Advisory Committee long range planning process. So I end up spending a lot of time answering email. I've been working with someone getting a contract together for the next DMT meeting that's going to be in October in Hawaii. So everybody who's listening and who's in DMT, now come to Hawaii. It should be great. I'm the secretary treasurer of the Division of Nuclear Physics. So that's part of my job is doing that. And I involve in organizing basically two meetings a year for just for APS. I'm involved in the International Advisory Committee of several other meetings, the CHARM conferences, Quarkonian Working Group, Hard Probes Conference. And I've been working on white papers for the long range plan. I've done a lot of different things. I mentioned JPSI. I've also worked on open heavy flavor. I've done ultra peripheral heavy ion collisions, clear effects on neutrino production, and then nuclear fission. I have a textbook on heavy ion collisions that was published by Elsevier in 2007. And I just had a book come out on January 1st, more or less, that I co-edited with Patrick Tulu from Los Alamos on nuclear fission. It's kind of interesting because I started out as ignorant as everybody else, and I don't feel like I'm very knowledgeable about nuclear fission, but I've learned a lot, and people seem to think I know a lot about it now. And also, I'm now associate editor of PRC. I was just on a call about that before I joined this meeting.
Wow. You wear a lot of hats.
I do try to get papers published once in a while. I mean, I've had one single author paper for a few years. So that's kind of nice.
I guess I have a few follow-up questions on that, because there's some things that we haven't touched on this season that it sounds like you're a part of. And maybe I can hear a little more about that. So you said you're involved a lot in the APS and the DMP. Could you maybe go into a little more detail of how that occurs and what the process of getting those positions are and what it's all about?
So APS is the American Physical Society. It advocates for physics. It has like 40 some different kinds of units. And these are, you know, organized around physics topics. So before I was Secretary Treasurer of the Division of Nuclear Physics, I held every office in the topical group on hadronic physics, which is a much smaller unit. So after you reach a certain size, 1 or 2% of the total APS membership, then your unit could go from a topical group to a division. And I suppose if you lose enough members from a division, it could go the other way again. But I don't know about that particularly. There are divisions and topical groups on science subjects, and then there's forums and there's sections. So sections are geographically oriented. Forums are broader interests, like forum on education or like that. And there's international physics, you know, industrial physics. There's a like early career forum and graduate student forum. So there are lots of different levels. You can join APS from the time you're an undergraduate student. I mean, a lot of people do their first conference talk at an APS meeting. The general contributed talks are like 12 minutes, so 10 minutes for the talk and 2 minutes for discussion. So that gives you not much time, but it gives you a chance to present what you're doing in a fairly non-judgmental way. People realize that, you know, students give talks, you know, typically very accommodating and fair. How did I get involved? In 2007, I was asked to run for member at large of GHP. And I was like, okay, I've never paid much attention to APS. I've been a member for a long time, but sure, why not? And I got elected. And then from there, I went into the chair line, and then it became Secretary Treasurer, and then eventually I became an officer in the DNP. You're nominated for office, provide a bio and statement to the nominating committee, and then that's put on the web. You're invited to vote in the election. APS members are allowed to vote in the general election for the president of APS, but only members of a particular group or unit are allowed to vote in elections for unit officers. And you get a chance to go to the leadership meeting typically in January, early February every year. And you get to learn about how APS works, basically. And you learn about how to communicate with the unit, how to organize meetings, how to do your financials, you know, those kinds of things. And it's very interesting. I met some interesting people there, and I have the medal ceremony. That's pretty nice. Is there anything else that you want to know about that per se? Or
I think you've answered a lot of those questions.
A lot of prizes and awards, but mm-hmm. The medal is sort of the big one. It was a new award that was endowed by a couple. And it's like a very large prize compared to the other APS prizes. It's not that big compared to, you know, the Nobel Prize or some of these other awards that are out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't know that even existed in the first place. So the one other thing I had to ask you about, one of your many hats, is you said you were on, you're a peer reviewer for referee or whatever for PRC.
Associate editor now.
Oh, associate editor. Yeah, my bad. Could you talk about that?
It's very new, just from the January 1st.
Uh-huh.
I'm still learning.
Yeah. Could you give any information on that?
Okay. So it's for physical review C. There are a number of APS journals. PhysRev C is for nuclear physics. There are other journals, like specifically for condensed matter physics or particles and fields, added, say, more specialized journals and also more general journals. I mean, Review of Modern Physics is a review journal. Physical Review Research is a more broad cross-cutting area journal. There are other levels too. There's open access journals. PhysRev 3 is hybrid because the APS journals are part of the Scope 3 agreement with CERN. Mm-hmm. So papers that fall under the high energy physics categories on archive are covered as open access papers. So if you say that your paper is on archive as a HEP-EX or HEP/PH mm-hmm. for phenomenology, or EX for experiment, TH for theory, whatever, then your paper will be open access and available right away. Otherwise, if you're not a subscriber, then you don't have access to the other articles until like a year later. So there are different levels. I mean, you're an author if you contribute to a paper is submitted to the journal. Your referee, if you're asked to, say, review a paper and see if it's worth publishing, and if it is, you know, what kind of APS has a bunch of outstanding referees who have, you know, written detailed constructive criticisms for their reports. That's been a thing since 2017, 14 maybe, something like that. Then there's editorial board members, and they get involved if there's a dispute between the author and the referees. They're supposed to handle disputes. And then the editors assign referees to the papers, and they look at the reviews, so they make decisions. They also make editor's suggestions. If you've seen those rev page, they're, you know, journal staff, including a managing editor and other, you know, people that work directly for the journal. So there's a whole hierarchy.
Yeah, it's really interesting. None of the podcasts that I've done so far have covered that, and I think that's an important thing for people to know, is there's a whole system with getting your papers published. And
yeah, I think the peer review process is important, not just because I've been in it for a while, but I think that's a good way of making sure there are like checks and balances. My goal as a referee has been to try to, unless the paper is like really, really bad, is to try and help the authors turn their work into a publishable paper.
That's good to know. Hopefully the referee is there to help you, not hurt you.
It's the idea. I mean, referees will also, paper is bad, and it's their duty to say so. I've rejected papers from one journal, and then I've gotten the same paper with no changes from another journal. Then I'll just send that journal my previous report and say, I rejected it from this journal. And then they say, thank you very much. Well,
interesting. Yeah. Anyway, so I guess we can move on, although this is very interesting topics, to the point of our podcast this season, which is the long range plan. So could you talk about your involvement in the long range plan?
Okay. So this is actually my first time being really involved in the long range plan, and now I'm really deeply involved. If in terms of the long range plan, as DNP Secretary Treasurer, I was helping with the discussing with the chairline about how, where the town hall meeting should be, who the conveners should be. And one of the things we did there was to ask for community input. So I made a Google form for people to fill out, send out an email through APS to DNP members, asking them to suggest people for not only the general conveners, but also for certain cross-cutting areas like nuclear data computing. We asked for community input for the conveners and for cross-cutting areas. And I mentioned nuclear data computing, workforce development, detectors and accelerator technology, isotopes. And there may have been one other that I'm blanking on right now. Sorry about that. We got a lot of great feedback. We got more than 80 responses, nearly 90. And based on those, we selected conveners for the various town halls. Also, based on requests from people inside the community, we decided the hot and cold QCD meeting should be at MIT. The nuclear reaction structure and astrophysics should be at Argonne. And the fundamental symmetry, neutrons and neutrinos meeting should be in North Carolina. I was also involved in the NSAC nuclear data subcommittee. I was asked to be on the organizing committee for the hot and cold QCD town hall. Each town hall, it's all set up different ways. It was very interesting to go to both the hot and cold QCD town hall and the nuclear structure, astrophysics. They did something different also. But the idea was to come up with recommendations, resolutions, initiatives, whatever. But we came up with different recommendations that we thought were important and also certain initiatives that would be good to do. And each town hall had a certain set that will be put into each town hall's white paper. And then those white papers will go to the long range planning writing committee. Then we will write the report. And in July will be a resolution meeting. And then in October, the plan should be done.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a lot of involvement that you have as well. So could you tell us a little bit more about the white papers that you're going to be putting together?
Okay, so each town hall has a white paper for their subfield of nuclear physics. And they typically benefit to some extent from white papers prepared by members of the community to use as background information. Now, it worked a little differently for the hot and cold QCD town hall because people are still working on white papers as well as our general white paper because our meeting was at the end of September. So it was fairly early on in the process. The call for the charge for the long range plan came in July. And by August, we had the conveners working, and the hot and cold QCD town hall was scheduled for the end of September. And then the nuclear structure reactions and astrophysics one was early November. And then fundamental symmetries, neutrons and neutrinos town hall was in the middle of December. So if you look at the webpage for the fundamental symmetries meeting, they have like nearly 20 white papers on their webpage. So they can benefit from having all of those in place, whereas we're still collecting white papers from people and have been working on writing the overall document ourselves with input from various people that we asked. I've worked a little on the white paper for Hadron Transport, mainly because they were interested in applications of transport. And so that was kind of related to some of the things I worked on for the nuclear data charges reports. They're not exactly white papers, they're reports to NSAC. They're standalone reports. So to back up a little more, NSAC received two charges in 2022. The first one was in April for nuclear data. So I can explain a little more about what nuclear data is in a minute, but just to say that there are two reports associated with the nuclear data one. One was the status of nuclear data in the US, and that was due at the end of September. And then the second report is due at the end of this month. And it's more like, where is the field going? How do we keep it vital and growing? Those two reports, while they're standalone reports to DOE and NSF, they can also be used to incorporate nuclear data into the long-range plan. So nuclear data is everywhere and nowhere, in the sense that people don't really think about it, but you know, you have to know enough about the properties of nuclei to know that americium is a good thing to use in your smoke detectors,
mm-hmm.
which isotopes are the best to use, say, in x-ray machines and to use in particle therapy. What kind of particles are you going to have hitting your spacecraft mm-hmm. when you send up a satellite or send somebody to Mars? Or and also the moon. We're not as tuned into that as, say, for the Apollo missions, I imagine. Experiment. You want to do a simulation. What's going to happen when a particle moves through your detector? Are you going to be able to stop it if that's what you want to do? Are you going to be able to see a trace of it if that's all you can do? How big does your detector need to be if you want to stop that particle?
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of space travel, what happens when a particle comes in and hits the spacecraft or comes through your shielding and, you know, hits the astronaut or flips a bit in your mm-hmm. electronics? You know, how many of those hits can you take before your electronics stops working? Things like that. Your nuclear data are evaluated to see, you know, which set of data is the best, because lots of people make measurements of nuclear reactions and nuclear structure. And a lot of this information, after there's an evaluation, gets compiled and it's centralized into databases. And not everything, every possible application is covered by all of the databases. To look at how to adjust nuclear data that's available to the needs of various communities. So there's been a push through NASA to find out more about higher energy nuclear data for their space missions. This includes like galactic cosmic rays, which are the things you encounter in space. Primaries have very high energy, much higher than any nuclear data table has right now that's accessible in general. And then when they interact, they create secondaries. And the secondaries, although they're lower energy, can do pretty much more damage. So it's the same kind of thing when you, at a different scale, when you're doing cancer therapy and you're trying to target a tumor. You send a beam directly into the tumor, but you know, it creates some secondaries and some of that can go outside of the area of the tumor. And you want to be able to figure out, you know, how important is that and how well you can focus that. So it's different application, but they're related. And this is what you're doing in high energy when you're trying to look at these space applications. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to model that. And I mean, that's not traditional nuclear data, but it is actually related to nuclear data. And it includes a whole host of other things like fission fragments. Yeah. Which are also created in our process, nucleosynthesis. Your gravitational wave signal that comes from like black hole mergers or neutron star mergers, those things create very neutron-rich nuclei, and then they get high enough up in the nuclear chart and they fission. And then those fragments come back down, they can build up again. And so that's all out there and it's all related to nuclear data. So I would be remiss if I didn't say that the keepers of nuclear data in the U.S. in terms of who hosts the databases is at Brookhaven
mm-hmm.
and the National Nuclear Data Center. Europe has its own library, and it's run partly through the International Atomic Energy Agency. There's the NEA, Nuclear Energy Agency in Paris. There's a Chinese equivalent. There's a Japanese equivalent, one in Russia. This is generally international, you know, there's generally a national cooperation in all of these. I've been to the IAEA to work on things related to fission fragments and fission in general. And there's a nuclear data conference every 3 years that brings people together from all over the world, all of these databases. You know, you can do your calculation or test your whatever with any of these databases because they all have the same format. And the format has until very recently just been based on punch cards. If you've ever seen a punch card, you know, 80 character format, this is the first line is, you know, this is line one. So you could put your punch cards back in order if they fell down on the floor. But now it's based on some other more natural way of looking at things, like MySQL, JSON files and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, that's just trivial, right?
you know, most people don't think of it. And, you know, people that like do simulations of using JAunt or Fluke to decide how much material they need to put in their hadronic calorimeter for the LHC or whatever. Those nuclear databases that I mentioned, they're embedded in those codes so deeply in some sense that they're kind of blind to them. So it's like a black box.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You did mention twice hadron transport. I don't think I heard of that. Could you explain what that is?
Particles are hadrons, right?
Yeah.
And transport just means like moving from one place to another, right? It's not hydrodynamics, which is like thinking of things like a fluid.
Mm-hmm.
That's also transporting, but it's more of how a set of particles behaves in a collision. And there are different ways of modeling it depending on the energy. So if you have a few hundred MeV, you can use something called molecular dynamics, which just follows the particles, assuming conservation laws and so on. Higher energies at RIC and the LHC, when you collide nuclei, you can create a quark-gluon plasma. So there's a phase transition and then those equation of state to make sure that the particles interact according to the equation of state. And the equation of state is different if it's hadrons only or if it's hadrons plus plasma, because you have a change of phase across the boundary. That's not my primary work, but it's actually kind of interesting and important for trying to model things better for these space applications, which I learned last year that people who are working on that are doing things in the way that the heavy ion community was approaching modeling back in the 1970s. We've done a lot better since then.
Yeah. Well, that's all really interesting, even if it's not your primary of research. However, we have been talking for a while about the research and all the technical aspects. So I'm about ready to move on to the fun personal questions, if you are.
Okay.
Yeah. So the first question is, when and how did you decide to become a physicist?
Well, I took physics class my last year of high school, which is way back in a small town in Southern Illinois. And no AP physics or anything. And there wasn't anything like that. But I found it the only class that I had in high school, really, that I thought was challenging, except for geometry. I hated doing geometry proofs, but it was challenging in a good way. I really liked it. But then I ended up going from high school to a two-year college that was local. I was taking engineering classes, and which included, you know, two full years of physics and chemistry and calculus and, you know, all that good stuff. And it was a lot of fun. At least the physics instructor was great. I thought he was fabulous. You know, his word problems on exams were all about Tarzan and Jane. You know, Tarzan, you know, got knocked out when he hit the tree and Jane is dragging him home. And yeah, what is the friction? Is, you know, things like that.
It's really funny.
It was very entertaining. He was great and sort of steered me into doing, you know, transferring. So I transferred to University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And then I went to graduate school at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, where I got into nuclear theory. And that was an interesting group.
Yeah.
When I was a grad student. Very, very passionate.
In a good way or?
mostly a good way. We would all tend to eat lunch together. And sometimes when the arguments got heated, somebody would gesticulate with whatever utensil they were using.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, everybody was generally pretty friendly, but they were still like very intense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's definitely good to be passionate about it.
Oh, yeah. Passionate. One time I talked to a bunch of Girl Scouts, you know, at a career event, and And you know, everybody was saying, I do this, that, and, you know, whatever I did, whatever, and I got it. I love physics. I said, I really love physics.
Yeah.
And I felt like, okay, maybe I shouldn't have been so practically jumping up and down about it. But
yeah. Well, maybe one of them got a little bit inspired, hopefully.
Yeah, who knows?
So beyond that, obviously, we had passionate physics and everything, but could you explain about any obstacles that you overcame along the way to your current position, as small as, you know, or I guess, you know, if it's something in your personal life, relatively small, but still affected your education, or big obstacles, people standing in your way?
Well, so like I come from a rural area. My father didn't finish his first year of high school. My mom was a school teacher. She got some teaching certificate somewhere and did a little bit of college. But I mean, she was her valedictorian of her high school, but she didn't get much opportunity from her rural high school either. She was very much wanting to push me to do whatever I felt like I wanted to do. But obstacle aside from general background, I shouldn't say all, but it's probably true that I think every woman in physics had some level of harassment, and had my share too. You just have to keep pushing through it. Like when I was at the two-year college, you know, having a ball talking to my instructor, the guys in the classes, they broke things, they sent me black flowers, that kind of stuff. I mean, nobody actually physically assaulted me there.
Yeah, it sounds really hard. I mean, yeah, I've heard, you know, there's a lot of experiences that are just bad with women in physics sometimes. And I guess if you do have to keep pushing on and, you know, hope that we can make a change for the better.
That's what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And that involves like making codes of conduct and community agreements and just basically trying to educate people.
Yeah, from what I heard, that's also a big part of a long-range plan this time around, right, is to improve diversity, equity, and inclusion. Have you had any part in that?
Yeah, I'm a member of the DNP Allies, and DNP does session chair training. So I've been doing session chair training, mostly on the technical side, but also like working with the allies and doing the conduct part too, since fall meeting in 2020. I guess my biggest contribution is like, in that sense, is like organizing those, you know, helping organize those training sessions and sitting in on all of them, because the platform has changed so many times. So I would always talk about the technical aspects of the platform, but you know, one of the things we always tell the chair is to please remind the participants about the code of conduct, mm-hmm. and to just be an upstander, if you will, you know, to keep things from getting personal. Mm-hmm. And it's fine to make criticism of science as long as it's a science you're criticizing and not attacking the person. But yeah, I'm hoping to contribute to the on diversity. Other things we do when we're working on formulating the invited sessions at meetings is that we ask, how do these speakers contribute to inclusiveness? And some people are better at coming up with an answer to that than others.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for sharing that as well. You know, your difficulties, we're trying to do something about that. Overall, it's just really inspiring that you also came from the rural town and had to deal with all that. So beyond that, quick change of subject, unless you have any more to say.
I had a two-body problem.
Maybe if you want to talk about that, it can be lighthearted. Maybe it'll help transition to the next one.
Well, so my husband is a physicist too, and he's more senior than me, and was already well established when we got married. So mm-hmm. I've been, you know, fairly fixed location-wise, which also made things a little bit difficult, but I've managed and he's been very supportive.
Yeah, that's always hard, but it's good when you have a supportive partner. So thank you for sharing that as well. All right, I guess we can transition. The last couple of questions I have, one of which you kind of already answered, but maybe repeat, is what do you do to relax outside of physics?
I make time to go running every day. and good way to work off steam sometimes, but it's also a lot of fun. I did my first marathon in 94. I did my first ultra marathon in 2004. I am not a great ultra runner. I'm very much tippy toe down steep slopes. You know, I won't do that in a race, but races are not designed to like put you in danger of your life. But with our running group, and we're doing some trail that I know I won't like, I'll just go around somewhere else. I'm on travel. I, you know, like when I mentioned going to GSI in the forest, I did one half marathon and then like 9-10 miles every other day pretty much while I was there. And that was a lot of fun, especially when it snowed. That was nice. I'm not used to snow out here in California very much. My daughter also runs ultra marathons. She's very competitive. And if you saw the picture that I provided, yeah, that's her next to me. She has the number F1 because she's won that 50K three times.
Wow.
Also mentioned Girl Scouts. I've been volunteering. I was a troop leader in my daughter's troop until they aged out. They started in second grade. That was about 10 years. And then I've been volunteering at a Girl Scout camp, a resident camp. I'm a driver floater, and which means that I have time to do physics when I'm not driving girls around or washing dishes. Washing dishes is fun.
Yeah.
I mean, handling stuff coming out of the big dishwasher is, I get a big kick out of that. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, music on, and it's a nice atmosphere most of the time. We have our camp names, and my camp name is Charm. and I like to explain that I wear nerdy physics t-shirts during camp. I have a chair that has the quark families painted on it. I have my clipboard with Feynman diagrams on it. So yeah, I make it very clear that I do science when I'm at camp. Yeah. Sometimes the girls will ask me like, oh, what are you doing? And I'm doing physics, or, you know, I'm grading abstracts, or I'm working on a paper.
Yeah, that's really cool.
I also have been judging at a local skills campery. I grade a quiz, and I've helped with the Nuclear Science Day for Scouts at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. That's a lot of fun. And I like telling for Scouts at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. It's a lot of nuclear physics was steered by women. And the only time I mention a guy was I say, oh, Fermi's got a Nobel Prize for discovering transuranic elements, but he actually didn't.
Yeah, that's really cool. That Nuclear Science Day is definitely inspiring. I have a friend who said that he was in the Boy Scouts, and that's what made him want to be a physicist. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
All right.
On the last question, if you have any last bit of general advice for students and young researchers, go ahead and give it now.
Well, I would say, especially to younger women, don't give up. It gets better. That's basically what's happened to me in my career. It was tough at the beginning, but it got better. I'm not too worried about people giving me a hard time now. If it's your passion, you know, then go for it. And it shouldn't matter where you come from. You can still do it.
Definitely. All right. One last question is, do you have any questions for me?
I could turn this around and ask you, how did you get started doing this?
So as a graduate research assistant, I'm on fellowship with Dr. Lin, and the old host, he is, I don't know what exactly he has going on, but this year has gotten really hectic for him. So he didn't think he had time. And Dr. Lin just asked, hey, do you want to do this? And now I'm here. So I'm definitely having fun, and I'm meeting a lot of people, and it's great to talk to people like you and hear inspiring stories and get lots of information.
Yeah, that must be really interesting for indeed. I remember one thing when I was at Stony Brook, was one of a couple of graduate students organizing discussions with the professors. And yeah, we would ask them for money, and we would bring in soda and pizza or something like that. And then they would come and talk about their research. this, like, not like in a structured class, but, you know, just later in the day, once a week or so. And I really appreciated that. I mean, it's not anything like podcasts where you get to meet people from way outside your university, but I got to know what everybody in the department was doing and got to know all the professors. And I thought that was really pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my equivalent, but not nearly so interesting as this.
That's always cool, getting to like seminar speakers, colloquium speakers. It's always fun to meet them. So yeah, it's been great having you, listening to you talk, all your inspiring stories and the information about physics and your research. So thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. This podcast was created by Brian Stanley and Professor Huihuan Lin. Season 3 was interviewed by Bill Good and edited by Vara Lee Sikorkar.